this out so I could get this right. We have got such a jewel this morning. My name is Bea Powell, and I am a member of the Cross Point 2014 Black History Committee. Other committee members include Tammy Bauer, Joseph Heath, Valerie McDowell, Sherry Solis, Trudy Williams, and Lee Powell. Each year, committee members go through a process of selecting a person or group that has been instrumental in creating a change for the people around them. This morning, we are honored to have a speaker whose experience and background will highlight this. Our speaker entered the U.S. Army at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas in 1942, where he completed his basic training. He was then shipped to Camp Lockett and was assigned to the 10th U.S. Cavalry. After the war, he worked for the U.S. Postal Service when he retired with 33 years of service. In 1993, our speaker was invited to join the education group of the Black Archives in Mid-America. His involvement has helped to increase the visibility of the history about the Buffalo Soldiers. December 7, 1993, our speaker was invited to the White House for the unveiling of the Buffalo Soldier stamp. In 97, he was sworn in as the first vice president of the National 9th and 10th Horse Cavalry Association. In 1998, he was selected as Mr. Juneteenth by the Black Archives of Mid-America. Currently, he continues to share his stories about the Buffalo Soldiers during World War II. Our speaker has one daughter who is with us this morning. If you would stand, please, we'd just like to say thank you for coming. Hello. Thank you. And he has several grandchildren. So please join me in a warm welcome for Trooper James G. Madison and his assistant, J.R. Bruce.
Good morning. I'm Trooper J.R. Bruce, and I'd like to, she already gave him his dues already, his name and what he did in World War II, but you know, it's a little bit beyond that because I know a lot of you know that the Buffalo Soldier was created in 1866. But through the years, it went on through these guys here and led a real deal to World War II veterans. So there's only a few left. There's not many of them. And I think their young was probably 80. And Mr. Madison's 91, and he still has the right mind and everything. He can tell me things about his horse and everything. And also, I'm very impressed about your display out there. That's very impressive. And I'd like to thank you for that display. Right now, I'm going to turn it over to Trooper James G. Madison of the U.S. 10th Cavalry.
Good morning, everyone. I will let you know that I was a draftee. I did not volunteer. See, a lot of people take pride in volunteering for things, but I learned early in life not to volunteer for nothing. Well, I didn't volunteer there, but I had to sign selective service and when I was still in school. When I graduated out of school, they sent me a letter and told me I was in A1, selective, so I could be called at any time. Well, later on in 1944, I got my number. My letter, and I had to report at Temp and McGee with the rest of the bunch there that rode up with me, and we all went to Leavenworth. That's where that I went through physical, and they checked me all out and everything, my health and all. Give me a couple of shots. And all, and that day was filled with mostly checking my health out and all, and getting me ready. The next day, had to take part in the swear-in ceremony. And they swore me in and all, and I had to take the Pledge of Allegiance and all that. Well, I got through that and all that. Well, they put me in a barracks, and I had to, around about 6 or 7 draftees to come in there, and they could not read and write. And I was surprised that they would have so many that could not read and write. And I had to at least go through and instruct them how to do that. Well, I spent that day and the next day teaching them how to read and write. Then that's when my orders come in for me to transfer to my regular post, whatever it's going to be at. Well, they transferred me from Leavenworth to Fort Riley, Kansas, that's Junction City. And that's where that I received, I think it's 12 weeks of base training. And that included going on the rifle range and trying myself out in shooting. It was 20 below zero at the time, and I had to put my hands on the barrel of the gun in order to keep my hands warm. But it didn't take no pity on you. They put me out there, and you had to do it. So I passed the rifle test and all, and then I was able to go in the background there where they had the targets and all. And they had a barrel with wood and stuff burning in there where you could kind of keep warm. Well, I went through that all right. And then I was on the pistol range the next day. And we had 45 Colts. Not Colts, but the automatics that they give us. We weren't allowed to have any Colt. There was cowboy pistols, they called them. They didn't give us none of them. We had automatics, and we tried out in there, and we've had to fire off so many. And then make you qualify there. You had to stay out there and shoot till you qualified. That's all that is. There wasn't no such thing as I can't do it. You did it. You were going to do it. Anyway, they passed that test. And, oh, heck, I was there. They read my qualifications there. They had a big sheet there where they'd ask questions and all that. So I passed the test there, and they put me in operations school, communication school. Well, I learned the Morse code in that, and I could take 15 words a minute longhand. Of course, the rest of the time there, well, heck, you had to take the rest of that test on the typewriter. Well, I didn't have any typewriting skills there. When I went to high school there, I put in for athletics, and then I didn't have time there to go to typewriting class. So then, after that, I got my orders to go to a regular camp. Well, the rumor was I was going to go to Oklahoma and be in the artillery. We rode so much on that train, that troop train, that I didn't know where I was at. I wound up in California. So they had us all get out of the train then, and we had to stand up and be counted for and everything. They call your name and all. And then they call mine. I answered, okay, I was there. And so after they called all the names and everything, well, I asked the captain, could I ask a question? He said, yes, you can ask me a question. Well, they told me that I was going to go to Oklahoma and said, this is California. He says, I think the Army made a mistake, didn't he? He said, let me tell you something, the Army don't make mistakes. You might have made one there when you got on that train, but see, they don't make mistakes. You're just where you ought to be, and this is where you're going to be. So that was that. Well, I think it's about a couple of days later, they introduced me to my horse. Now, before that there, before I went in the service there, I didn't ride no horse like they did to have a saddle and everything like that. The only horse I rode there was the one that pulled the ice wagon. And I could ride him on weekends there whenever my grandfather was through working, you know. He hauled ice and wood and like that. That's how that he made a living for us. No. Okay, after we lined us all up, and they had a corral there about a block square. Great big corral there. Ran about 400 or 500 horses there. And well, they all had names, I guess, and everything like that. And so when they had us all lined up, well, top sergeant always, he called a roll. He called my name and said, okay, you're next. You're going to go up there and ride this horse. Well, I said, okay. I had never ridden a horse before, not in no saddle. Anyhow, he had my saddle there. Well, heck, I'd learned how to saddle a horse in the classroom, see, in Fort Riley, so I knew how to tighten the cinch up and all that. So I saddled the horse up, and he said, top sergeant said, okay, ride him. Well, I didn't get on him in there. I tightened the cinch up again because they had taught me that the horse would swell up when you first tighten the cinch up, and then 2 or 3 minutes later there, he'd exhale, you know. And he'd be about a couple of inches smaller. And so I retightened the cinch up, and then I got on him. Well, I wasn't on him 1 minute. I barely got on him before he threw me off. Well, top sergeant said, get back on him. I got back on him, and I wasn't on him 2 minutes before he threw me again. And then all the time the horse was throwing me there, he wouldn't go nowhere there. He'd let me get myself together and everything and try it again. Third time there I got on him, he threw me again. Well, I kind of getting a little bit mad now. And I didn't want to get tired of getting up. So I made up my mind what I was going to do until that sergeant I could do with that horse. But I happened to think about that when I was in Fort Riley that I think it's a top sergeant and one of those privates there had a misunderstanding and they went in the back of the barracks there to settle it. You know, that's where you can settle all the arguments and everything like that. And they come back out there, heck, that private was bleeding in the mouth and everything, and that had a fist fight back there. And so I thought about that, and I said, hell, that top sergeant weighed about 250. I weighed about 110, 115. I said, well, to myself, I said, hell, I'm not going to take no damn beating. So I kept my mouth shut. Got back on the horse again and tried him again. He threw me that time. That made about the fifth time he threw me. And I'm really getting uptight now. Finally, I don't know that I stayed on him the last time I got on him. That gone there, the horse didn't buck me off. He just took me around the circle of the corrals. And that gone there, about a couple of times there, we went out and then they opened the big gate and let him out. As they go and he took me all up in the woods and got in one of them low limbs and he knocked me off of him. So there I was. Off the horse and the horse is gone. Finally I had to walk all the way back to where the rest of them were lined up at and everything. The top sergeant says, where is that horse? I told him, I said, hell, I don't know where he's at. He's somewhere. Well, you go to do 2 weeks of stable patrol. And I thought to myself, I said, well, I can walk up and down the stable there and patrol that with that rifle and all that. So he said, report to Corporal Lynch. I reported to Corporal Lynch, and I told him I was ready to take up my punishment there. The heck, I was supposed to get 2 weeks of stable patrol. Says, give me my equipment, and I'm waiting. He went in a little room, had a little tack room. And I thought he was going to come out with a rifle. And he come out with a pitchfork. He had, and he said, Dick, you take this. You start at this first stall, and you go on up to the end, cross back over, and come down the other side of the barn. He didn't have a barn with 24 stalls in it. 12 on each side. He said, now you clean the manure there on that side of the barn and then come right, cross over and come right down and clean the other side. The time you get through with that, it'll be time for you to go to the barracks and go to the mess hall and eat. Well, he was right. I had to clean up the daggone stalls on both sides, go down there and eat, and then come back and finish up. I had to do that every day for, I think it was 2 weeks. And that includes Sundays. Heck, you wasn't off no weekend or nothing like that. You had to do it every day, every day. Of course, on Sundays, We didn't have as much work because most of the horses there were already in and already been cleaned up and everything. And all you had was a few. But you had to wash that horse there. He had to wash his eyes out, ears, nose. And you go around to the back there and you say to the doctor, you got to wash that too. With a sponge. Okay. I did that for 2 weeks. And then I was complaining there in the mess hall that one of those cooks heard me. And he told me, he said, come here. Let me tell you something. He said, you get an apple there every day at lunch. You ought to save that apple there and give it to that horse, hadn't it? Just hold it up to him, man. If he smells it there, he'll go on and eat it out of your hand. I did that, and I kind of made up with that horse, and that way there he didn't want to throw me no more. And I could curl him down, clean his hoofs out, and wash him up and everything like that, and do that every day. So I had to do that every day after, to start my training. Well, I got so I can make it with the horse every day, and then we'd go on in them rides. We'd be in one of those dried up creeks. It ain't nothing but sand there. Odd thing about it, one of the guys that rode the horse, he fell off. Well, heck, didn't nobody see him. Well, some of them seen him fall off, but I didn't see him anyway. So we got to where when the heck we take a little rest, and the collar rolled, and this guy didn't answer. Got on the horse and they went back about a mile there, and there he was laying there in the sand there at sleep. He's one of them guys there that had sleeping sickness or something that just says he couldn't do anything, he couldn't stay awake. And had sent him out there to train with us there, and heck, and that's when they had to take him in then. So I don't know what happened to him after that. But after we had so many of those training sessions there, well, we went out on the range again. This time there, we had to go through an obstacle course. They had a fence all around about all 6 foot tall, something like that. Very, very long fence. And he was cut off for about 17 inches from the ground. You had to crawl under that fence. And they had a 30 caliber machine gun tied down to the ground. And they would fire that rapid fire. And you had to crawl up under there, that wire 17 inches, in order to keep from getting hit. Well, there was firing live ammunition, so you didn't have to worry about no blanks going off. So there's one guy there that he run up on a snake. And when he jumped up, doggone there, he got hit with the bullets. The bullets got him. And of course, that stopped everything for a minute until they can get him out of there. And we had to continue on doing that. Well, I trained like that for 2 weeks. And then, we was getting orders to go overseas. And I had to turn in. The meantime, I turned in my boots and saddle and everything that was with the cavalry. And turned that in, and we exchanged there for combat equipment. Well, you didn't have any boots and no saddles like that, but you had these old fatigue clothes. They called them fatigues, and of course I did too. And that's what it, we went through this obstacle course with, crawling up under the rifle fire. Okay, after we got through with that, we boarded a troop train there, and we went all the way from California to Newport News, Virginia. Of course, it took a couple of days. And that night, we could only exercise ourselves there around midnight, way in the middle of a field somewhere. Because during the day, we had to have the shades down on the troop train because we were going through the south. And that's where that they'd see black folks on the soldiers on the train that throw rocks at it and rock the train and everything. And we had to go through that for 2 days before we got to Newport News. We got to Newport News, and then you had to go through some kind of a course where they had a doctor on each side of you, and you go down there, and a couple of them there were shooting you in one arm and taking your blood with another. Like that, and the time you got through with that there, you was just about ready to fall out. You was full of shots and weak from taking blood and everything else. All right, I got through that day. And the next day there, I was able to go to the service club. Went to the service club at night, and they had a big rope tied from one end of the bar to the other, to the back end. And I wanted to know what the rope was for. He said, well, hell, that's to separate the black soldiers from the white. And that's what it's for. So I had to drink my beer on the black side. You know, they pawned it out. And just about 11 or 12 o'clock there, we had the soldiers started getting a little bit high there, and then they got to fussing, and that way there, they tore the rope down, and that's when the riot started. Well, they tore that service club up, went on into the theater, and they tore all the seats out of it. And then they were raising so much cane that they had to call Washington, D.C. to get the National Guard to come down there and stop the riot. Well, the National Guard come down there, and they had submachine guns. That's the only time that I ever seen a real live submachine gun with a drum on it, hold 50 bullets in it. Well, that's what the National Guard had. And the next morning, around about 3 o'clock in the morning, they had us lined up. It was still dark, and they had around about 12 of these National Guardmen on either side of the gangplank with the submachine guns. And that's when they lowered us on the boat. Time they got us all on the boat and then going there. Daybreak there, well, heck, that's when they took out. We was on that boat there for about 7 days. And then we landed in Casablanca, North Africa. Well, I had read about Casablanca and seen it in the movies, but I had never seen it. Anyway, we landed there. Well, heck, it was a camp right on the, after you get off the boat there and on the dock, and there's a big field there in the camp. They called it Music Hill. And they had a band that played band music all day long. And then I asked them, I said, I wonder what in the world are they playing music all the time for? He said, to make the prisoners line up and keep step with it. I believe it was a prisoner of war camp. And that word was that. Well, we wasn't in it, but we could see them. And we could hear that doggone band playing all the time. Anyway, we had to make our bed on the ground at night. And all we had was a pack, and it had a blanket in it. And we had to smooth those rocks out where they wouldn't perp you. And make it smooth enough for you to lay on with the blanket down there, and you lay it on that, because they said you had to lay there on the ground with those rocks built up to keep the dampness from coming in on you at night. Because, heck, it'd probably catch pneumonia if the dude would dampen you up too much. Okay, we had to do that night. The next day, we all call roll again, and they put us on one of those little trains they have. But they had a horn on them there, just like a kitty horse or something like that. Just a toot, toot, toot. But that thing will toot on you there, and you better be on it. Because if you get left there, you'd have to ride with somebody else. And that way, you wouldn't know who in the world you was riding with anyway, let alone where you was going. But anyway, we got on that doggone train that they had there. And we rode that thing till we got to another place of embarkation where we had to load on another boat. Well, that boat went through Straits of Gibraltar and landed on Naples, Italy. And that's where the heck it we got off. We unloaded right on the top of an overturned boat in the bay. It'd been submarined and shot down. So we unloaded right on that. Got in there around about dark. And then we was all in the vacant, was in the vacant schoolhouse or something like that. And they had the sirens there going, but just had them truck sirens, and we had our air raid come in. Well, two or three German planes come in, dropping bombs and strafing and everything like that. And all you could do was stay in that doggone room, look out the window there and see him. You could see the trace of bullets and everything going and everything. It was just like looking at a 4th of July celebration or something like that, but they were shooting real bullets. After that air raid there was over, it lasted about an hour, and then everybody was getting themselves together and counting the ones that got hit, because the bomb that they dropped there was personnel bombs, and the shrapnel would get you if you was in any ways close to it. So after we got out of that night, the next day they carted out the ones that got wounded, had a roll call there and everything, and we had to stay in that daggone vacant building for 2 days. And every night, there's an air raid there that you could just about count on it. Certain time where them planes would come over and they'd start to drop in bombs and strafing you. We were protected by the British anti-aircraft, and they didn't seem to be able to hit nothing. At least they couldn't hit them doggone planes as it was running. And after around about a week of that, it's in the air raid every night. After that, we got assembled and we moved up. So we moved up about 100 miles up in the peninsula of Italy. And that's where we was hit with another air raid, because we were hauling food and ammunition and stuff to the front lines there in a convoy. And I had a 2.5-ton truck behind another guy. And I had it loaded up with food and ammunition and stuff. But I was lucky not to get hit. But the air raids continued. And they would bomb them doggone convoys every night. You couldn't even down light a cigarette or anything, because they could see it from the air, whatever it was. Then even down a pistol or something like that. Especially there, the pistols that the Germans would lay out for these. For you to pick up as a souvenir. You pick up one of them souvenirs and that gun, if it don't blow you up, it catch you at night there and drop a bomb on you. So we had to go through that. Had about 2 or 3 weeks. Not every night, but every other night. You could just about tell what was going to happen by the sound of the airplane. You know, they could have a different sound to them, the bombers and the others. I could rest that a while.